are back. Hi, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you once again. If you're new to this radio program, I'm your host, Henrik, from Sweden, and this is Intrepid and Independent Red Ice Radio. Our website is redicecreations.com and, of course, redicemembers.com. That's where we have our entire archives for you. Well, today we are talking with Brandon Martinez. He's an independent writer and journalist from Canada who specializes in foreign policy issues, international affairs, and 20th and 21st century history. For years, he's written on Zionism, Israel-Palestine, American and Canadian foreign policy, war, terrorism, and deception in media and politics. There's no lack of that now, is there? He is the author of Grand Deceptions, Zionist Intrigue in the 20th and 21st Centuries. He's also written Hidden History, and the most recent one, which is going to be our main topic here today, is called The ISIS Conspiracy, How Israel and the West Manipulate Our Minds Through Fear. Before we get to the main target here of today, which is the ISIS conspiracy, as Brandon has researched it, in the first hour we are going to set the stage, if you will, and talk about some of the history, about how the Zionist project came together and crystallized after World War II, as Brandon asserts that Germany was used, pushed, and even encouraged to go into the situation that was laid out for her in order to fulfill the so-called prophecy of Israel. Stay tuned. Brandon, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today. Hope you're doing well today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on.
You bet. So we had Joshua Blakeney with us here a couple of weeks ago, and of course you also write for Non-Aligned Media, so we wanted to bring you on and talk about some of your writing. You do talk about a lot of different topics. You have a couple of books out there, three, I think, actually. So what happened with Joshua? When did you join in with Non-Aligned Media?
Well, Non-Aligned Media, we started this about September 2014. And, you know, I had been writing for various blogs and doing my own independent thing for a while. And, you know, my background is sort of journalism. So, you know, I went to journalism school for a year, learned some things. You know, I'd already been interested in conspiracies, government corruption, geopolitics. These are things that interest me immensely. So I'd already been well-read and learned in those areas before I even went to journalism school. So journalism school was kind of this amateurish thing for me where I was, you know, way ahead of everybody else there. Most of the people who go to journalism school are very superficial, you know, that they're into sports or celebrities. They want to write about music, and that's fine. People can write about what interests them, but to me, you know, I always felt like, you know, mainstream media obviously is completely controlled and has been nothing more than a tool of the economic and political elites. It operates as a tongue of the regime for the most part in various countries. Even most of mainstream media is even state-funded in the West and in other countries, or it's controlled by corporations or very select few people. So to me, mainstream media was never an avenue that I felt like I would succeed in, because, you know, my interests were exposing the powers that be. You know, I wanted to delve into the controversial issues right away and tackle the taboo subjects, which the mainstream media refuses to pursue because it bumps up with the interests of the rich and powerful. So, you know, I always knew that mainstream media was completely out of the picture for me, and I would never make it there, nor did I want to even pursue that. So, you know, I left journalism school, and I was doing my own independent writing for outlets like Press TV and a few other alternative media outlets. So I dove right into the alternative media right away because I felt like those were the only platforms that would even give me a voice. You know, if I would send my articles to mainstream media outlets, immediately they'd be rejected. They wouldn't even respond to me, right? So there's very few outlets that exist today that are willing to publish alternative commentary as it relates especially to foreign policy and geopolitics. I mean, this is where you have the interests of the most powerful players in the world, and when you're challenging those powerful people and their narratives and their official stories, you're really not going to get very far unless you have your own platform, your own independent media that will publish those things. So I decided to start my own website, nonalignmedia.com. And, you know, I've been familiar with Josh's work for a while. He worked for Press TV, and I had written for Press TV. So we were kind of familiar with each other and each other's work and discourse for a while. And, you know, we met up and we decided, you know, why not start our own website? Why not, you know, we can't rely on anybody else to publish our work. There's even alternative media outlets out there that refuse to cover certain issues, you know, especially the very, very taboo issues, which had been my focus, which is things like 9/11, things like World War II, historiography. You know, these are areas that I had kind of excelled in and taken a keen interest in and pursued, and these outlets just refused to touch that. So we decided to start our own website, and we publish our own material. We do, you know, video. We have a podcast, and we just are trying to branch out. We're now publishing books, so we publish our own books, and we're accepting other submissions and from people. We have another book coming out from a journalist from Britain. So we're just trying to expand and build a base for ourselves, you know.
Yep, that's the way to do it. If we want to have it done right, you got to do it yourself. Of course, it's good to cooperate with others nonetheless, but I think the more kind of cells we have out there, the more decentralized things are, the better. But let me just ask you briefly, how did you wake up to some of these topics then? Did you just say, well, I'm going to go into the controversial one day, or what happened?
Well, it was sort of a slow-moving process. You know, when I was younger, I had always been fascinated and intrigued by, you know, mysteries and conspiracies and the unexplained. So from a very young age, I you know, felt like we weren't being told the full truth on an array of different issues. So, you know, I always had this curiosity through my personality, right? So, you know, when I got older, it didn't really coalesce until I was about, you know, 18, 19 years old, when I started to really think about these things and started to read and started to, you know, watch alternative documentaries and try to, you know, find the truth myself, instead of letting some teacher or professor just feed me a bunch of lies and try to brainwash me into some conformist system. So I'd always been sort of a rebel and questioning authority, and that's the, you know, that's where it starts. It starts where, you know, people are trained to believe that they have to obey an authority, that authority figures know better than you, and that they have all the answers, that they have more knowledge, and you just listen and absorb that information and regurgitate it. And that's how schools are run today. You know, the public schools, they don't encourage critical thinking. They don't encourage questioning authority. They encourage just parroting the narratives that they want you to believe. So, you know, I had always rebelled against that and felt like that was not the way to find the truth. And so, you know, this kind of led me into pursuing these topics. And, you know, and then I, you know, became interested in journalism. I felt like, you know, I had to say something. I can't just read and watch documentaries and just, you know, retain this information in my brain. You know, I have to expose this. I have to tell people about this. You know, I have to be a voice for people who are voiceless, that don't have a platform, and try to get these things out. So that's when I decided, you know, I wanted to be a journalist and a writer. And, you know, there's different forms of journalism. You know, there's reporters, which we need, you know, people who just are sort of stenographers who go to a certain event happens, and they go there and they write down what happens, and they have to keep their opinion out of it. But, you know, that's one aspect of journalism which is needed, but that wasn't really my interest. That wasn't, you know, something that I wanted to pursue, because I was more interested in opinion and history. You know, my writing can be considered opinion writing, but it's also factual and evidence-based, and I incorporate logic and reason and just try to delineate and cut through the spin of mainstream media, of government propaganda. So, you know, that's where I ended up going, and, you know, I've written 3 books now. I'm constantly writing op-eds and talking about these things on radio, so it's just going to grow from here.
You know, I want to ask you just a little bit before we move on about how things are in journalism school, that you, as you perceived it. I mean, you do get, of course, as you say, the kind of the general yoke, and then you kind of get the few, I guess, more pro-establishment rebels who think they are, you know, underdogs by tackling some of the hard issues in the way, of course, the establishment approves of, kind of the controlled counter narrative to a certain extent. But is there any, you know, because I've always wondered why journalists seems to be so, you know, controlled right out of the gates. They know which things you talk about. They know which things to avoid and not talk about. Certainly there's a editorial level where things get kind of snipped and end up on the floor, if you will. But nonetheless, Is there any, did you encounter any people that were driven in that capacity to really find out and learn and go the extra mile to get through the truth, right?
Yeah, I mean, with journalism school, for the most part, it was a younger generation. Most of the people that I went to school with were either my age or younger than me. I'm 24, so most of them were just coming out of high school, and they're not really encouraged to question, you know. So they've been brainwashed, and their minds have been shaped by the popular media, and they reflect that in the things they want to pursue. And it's like a peer pressure thing, and just the fact that society has fashioned taboos around certain subjects will inevitably prevent people from pursuing that, especially journalists, is, you know, in considering the money factor, the economic factor behind it, because these people want to make a career out of this and they want to be able to sustain an income. And the only way to do that in journalism, of course, is to sort of sell out, you know, is to kind of just offer yourself up as a mouthpiece for the regime or for this or that cause or for special interest groups, right? So a lot of these people are opportunists. They go in thinking just they want to make money. They don't really care. They don't have any underlying principles that drives their journalism. That they're just looking for fame, prestige, and money. And it, not all of them are like that. Some of them might have some, you know, social justice kind of prerogative to them. But
yeah.
Ultimately, you know, they're going to realize that there's certain topics and issues that are so taboo and just too scary for them to approach. And this is what I seen. You know, I was really the only one that really had any kind of knowledge on these things, because all of these topics are heavily censored and controlled in schools and universities and the mainstream media. So alternative theories about 9/11, for example, or World War II, or any of the big topics are, you know, controlled, and they're tightly monitored by the establishment. So these kids, a lot of them don't even have a good understanding of what really goes on, of what history is and what really happened, the real story behind things. So they kind of believe the lies, you know, they kind of, you know, just kowtow to whatever they've been told, and tends to reflect in their journalism. So unfortunately, not so many people, you know, people have kind of been trained to be apolitical, you know, elites and politicians and bankers and whatnot, and the people who really shape the discourse and are the architects of popular culture, they don't want you to be interested in politics and history. They want you to be interested in trivial nonsense. You know, they want you to worship celebrities and sports stars as demigods. You know, that is the popular culture that we have today, yeah. And it's reflected across the board. It's reflected even in mainstream journalism when they're doing silly stories about utter nonsense, like Justin Bieber and Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, when they should be covering real issues. And the way that they cover real issues is very trivial. It's very unprofessional. They don't ask tough questions. You see these politicians, when they're getting interviewed by mainstream journalists, they throw softball questions. They don't pursue any serious line of inquiry against them. And everything's prepackaged. You know, these politicians won't even give interviews unless they get the questions beforehand, and it's very controlled and monitored. The mainstream media is basically you know, on a leash, and the governments just manipulate them and threaten them if they don't, you know, toe the party line in many respects.
Yeah, you know, it's like the boat is on fire, and the hole has a hole in it, and they're absolutely occupied with the bells and the whistles, and it seems like a lot of people just don't appreciate the value and the importance of really digging deep into these questions. And it's amazing to see how homogenous the environment really is out there too, and they immediately know out the gate what is okay, what is not okay, and let's be honest about this. We see this a lot in the alternative too, where if you start going into some of these areas without making any value judgment necessarily on the material itself, they resort to the same level of name calling as the mainstream does. They just don't seem to understand the reason why you'd want to turn the stones, you know, that the mainstream have left unturned, and of course the omissions and everything else, and you end up receiving tremendous flack, and you're just not allowed to look at some of these issues. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, I think there's a certain degree of control that's exercised even over alternative media. There's a lot of opportunists and people who don't have principles and don't pursue the truth wherever it happens to lead, which is what I do and what anybody with character does. These people want to get attention, or they want to get a piece of the pie, so to speak. They want to advance, and I'm talking about people like Alex Jones. These people have tried to sort of make a name for themselves and get a spot in this burgeoning pseudo alternative media that we see emerging. And it's really just comes down to money, and money corrupts, and anybody can, not everybody, but most people can be bought. And that's what we see. And there's just certain topics that are so taboo and can be, and it's like they can enforce this political correctness even on alternative media, mainly because, they have either direct influence with that media, or it's just those people, aren't really even educated on the issues. World War II, for example, this is a topic that is so frowned upon in terms of exploring alternative views. In some countries, for example, there's actually laws in place that prevent you from challenging the official establishmentarian view of the Second World War. So governments can even, create this climate of fear by making it illegal to even question. So in France, for example, comedians like Dudenay and intellectuals like Alain Sorel, they challenge establishment narratives, and they're certainly targeting the Zionist element within the establishment, and just ridiculing it with jokes. I mean, even that is deemed illegitimate in that country, and it is criminalized. These are things that people have to take into consideration. So there's definitely a fear factor involved, and there's all kinds of maneuvers that governments are attempting to suppress speech. I mean, this is one of the things that we see today with this whole terrorism narrative. I talk a lot about terrorism and geopolitics and where this stuff comes from and who's really behind the terrorism and what the purpose of it is. And we see the governments now are fervently pursuing an agenda of suppressing civil liberties, right? We had the Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, who gave a speech at the United Nations where he basically said that people who question the official stories of 9/11 or 7/7 or these other dubious terrorist attacks are akin to ISIS, are nonviolent extremists that need to be treated similarly to criminals, right? So yeah. You see these governments trying to cook up this narrative where even questioning their foreign policies, for example, is deemed a criminal offense. I mean, this is something that we would expect to find out of the Soviet Union, out of the Stalinist times, but it's starting to pop its head up in the West. And terrorism is, a completely manipulated thing in the West. It's used to scare people firstly. And obviously it's used in a second way to launch foreign policies that otherwise, populations wouldn't consent to if they weren't scared into consenting to it, into, approving of some aggressive invasion. So it's used in two ways, and right now we see this huge hype and build up with this ISIS phenomenon and this the new boogeyman, the new Osama bin Laden is here to get you. They're under every corner, they're there to get you and to kill you, and the only way that we can protect you is if you willingly give us your freedoms, relinquish your freedoms. We're going to pass legislation that emboldens the police state, emboldens the intelligence agencies, and gives the state more power. And it's a perpetual scam and racket because, this is how they frame it. Something happens, there's a terrorist attack or a shooting or whatever, and they say, oh, look, the only way we can stop something like this is if you let us pass this terrorism bill, which gives the security agencies unlimited powers to spy and tap your phones and monitor your internet and so forth. But it's a scam because then some other attack happens and they say, oh, we need more power. We need another bill. oh, we couldn't stop this one either. We need another bill. Well, the fact is that the reason you couldn't stop it, it's not that you couldn't stop it, it's because you created it. You engineered it from the get-go, or at the very least, you let it happen. So there's a let it happen type of aspect of terrorism. There's also a make it happen. You know, operations, for example, that are way too sophisticated for a bunch of ragtag amateurs to pull off. It's the intelligence agencies, it's the professional killers who of the state who conduct these operations, you know, things like 9/11 and 7/7. I mean, these are far too sophisticated for any group of amateurs who were training on monkey bars and caves to pull off. And then they've hoodwinked us, you know, with the popular media, with the mainstream media, into consuming some official story, some official narrative, you know, pushing that official narrative consistently. And it's not like governments have any concern for proving their case or, you know, going through the justice system. They don't care about those things. You know, as soon as a terrorist attack happens, they instantly start pointing their fingers at the boogeyman that they want to blame. They don't have a trial, and they don't pursue evidence. They just blame the scapegoat and then launch into their foreign policy agenda, which ends up, you know, usually being a war. So, you know, this narrative has been formed around conspiracy theories, right? The mainstream media likes to denigrate skeptics, dissenters, and critics by labeling them conspiracy theorists. Now, if we pick apart this term, you know, conspiracies, I mean, it's just two or more people getting together behind the scenes to commit a crime. It happens all the time. A bank robbery involving two or more people is a conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy is actually one of the, you know, a charge that gets leveled against criminals in many, many court cases. So this idea that conspiracies never happen is absurd. This is really just a statist mythology that they've created, that governments don't do conspiracies. It's just ordinary average citizens that do it. But governments, they don't do anything like that. We're really well behaved over here.
Of course.
But you know, then theory, this idea that it's bad to have a theory, well, how did we get all of our scientific theories? You know, we test them. We come up with a theory, and then we test the theory, see if it holds up to scrutiny. I mean, that's what the scientific method is all about. But they've tried to demonize that methodology. And insofar as they've manipulated the discourse, but they've also they revealed their hand, they revealed their hypocrisy, because governments are the biggest progenitors of conspiracy theories. You know, as soon as a terrorist attack happens, they posit a conspiracy theory. Al-Qaeda did 9/11. 19 hijackers directed by a man in a cave did it. That's a conspiracy theory. It has absolutely no proof. They haven't even offered a semblance of evidence for that. And they launch all kinds of wars and aggressive maneuvers based on a pure conjecture, you know, pure theorizing that cannot be demonstrated to be true in any capacity, and certainly has been proven false time and time again. So we have this manipulation of language going on too, and this is kind of how they control people's minds, is they come up with these phrases and terms. You know, anti-Semite, for example, I mean, this is a term that gets thrown at anybody who criticizes Israel, who criticizes Zionism, or the abuses of Zionist power. I mean, it for you to be called anti-Semitic for, you know, condemning or criticizing the bad behavior of Zionists who wield an inordinate amount of power, that's absurd. You know, that doesn't make any sense. If somebody does something bad and you condemn it and you criticize it, you're the principled one. You know, you're the one that has morals and sees something that's wrong for what it is, and you're identifying that. But what they're doing is they're just calling you a name. You know, they're just saying you're this, you're that. If you criticize you know, Israel's massacres in Gaza of thousands of people, including hundreds of children, you're just anti-Semitic, which de facto means, from their perspective, that all criticism of us is invalid. You know, they're saying, right, we can do whatever we want. Yeah. We can murder 10,000 people. We can drop white phosphorus. We can commit war crimes. And if you criticize us, you're just anti-Semitic, and there's nothing you can say that is valid, legitimate criticism of us, because we're above you. You know, we're above laws. We're above, you know, human morality. We're above all these concepts. We make our own morality, and our morality is we can rule you. We have a divine right to rule you, as these Old Testament fundamentalists believe, and then they enact those policies, and we see that today in so many ways.
And this is the very reason why it is so tremendously important to look at the charges that are made, you know, against, for example, Germany. It's important to re-examine what happened during World War II. It's important because this protected status has only come about in a certain way with the current narrative. And if that's true, then there should be no problem with investigating that and coming to those same conclusions. The problem, however, is that most of the people who get into this field are, well, first of all, incredibly demonized. They lose careers, they're fired, they're ostracized by their friends and family, they're completely pushed to the margins of society. But nonetheless, despite all those hardships, what's so amazing is that most people, they still keep investigating, because it seems to me anyway, when I look at their material, they're just not finding the same type of material that we're told that they're supposed to find, right? So all of that is connected together, and that's the reasoning of why we have to examine, you know, okay, what happened during that time? You know, if these terms are thrown around all the time, what does that really mean? And are the charges that are made against, for example, you know, Europeans today, when they, you know, bundle everyone together, now it's not only, you know, Germans and the Nazis' fault, now it's like, you know, Europeans' fault because they didn't do enough to stop this, etc. We've heard all these terms, right? But that's the crux of the matter, in my view. What do you think, Brennan?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, what they're pursuing in terms of their manipulation of language and demonization of skeptics. You know, the idea that somebody who pursues alternative views on World War II is just motivated by hatred or malice or has some sort of economic motive. I mean, these are the ludicrous assertions that have been posited by, you know, the Zionist establishment insofar as they've tried to demonize, you know, researchers, simple researchers and historians who just look into the evidence from an unbiased perspective and look into the scientific evidence and they've come to a different conclusion. The idea that there's some economic motivation to it is so absurd when we consider that almost every single researcher into World War II who has, you know, questioned the official narrative has been bankrupted, has been fined, has been sued, and they still continue to pursue the research. Well, what that tells you that this person is absolutely not motivated by anything malevolent, but is motivated by a search for truth, and has been so convinced by the evidence that they're willing to suffer hardship to get that information out to the public. So in a very real sense, the alternative historians on World War II are idealists. You know, they're moralists. They're people who, you know, have recognized that lies have been told about groups of people and have been used, those lies have been used to further oppress other people today, you know, because, you know, we cannot separate really World War II from the modern context, because the World War II historiography informs everything that happens today and is really the bedrock foundation of the New World Order that sprung forth as a result of World War II and the victors of World War II who are at the spear tip of this pursuit of global government and global power and control. So, you know, we can't separate the two things, and by shattering the myths of World War II, by taking down the propaganda and lies and deception that have been used to, you know, to prop up the State of Israel and create this Zionist American empire that we see enveloping the globe, shattering those myths is really going to be have a liberating effect, you know, on not only the people who are currently being, you know, most fervently oppressed in the form of bombing campaigns and wars that are being launched in the Middle East on behalf of Israel and the U.S., but also, you know, the people who have been maligned historically and vilified based on, you know, distorted information, misinformation, and simply lies. So, I mean, the pursuit of truth is a very liberating thing, and to me, we cannot really put any kind of faith in any sort of government body to help us in this respect, because, you know, a lot of people today, you know, want to look at Russia as some sort of liberating force, but Putin recently passed a law in Russia banning revisionist views on World War II, banning any criticism of the Soviet Union, you know, the Soviet Union's role in World War II, which was a bloody and brutal, you know, participation in that war, and the Soviets were part of the victors of that war, so of course they have to suppress the official historiography. They were, you know, essential and crucial to the mythology of World War II. They, you know, a lot of the lies about the concentration camps and so forth emerged from the Soviet Union and came out of the Soviet propaganda machine. So, of course, Putin has to try to suppress that. Of course, China would want to suppress that because these people were all – these governments were all aligned during the Second World War. And what we have today is this emerging New World Order where the entire world has been divvied up between the big powers of the West and the big powers of the East. So during World War II, you know, the United States and Britain joined forces and formed the brunt of the Allied forces, and the Soviet Union came in on that, China came in on that, and, you know, Roosevelt after the war, he even suggested and promoted the idea of the United States, Britain, Russia, and China being the policemen of the world, where they get to dictate to everybody else how they should run their internal affairs, how they should run their foreign affairs, what kind of weaponry countries can have, what kind of military capacity countries can have. So they wanted this global police force, and that's effectively what we have today. You know, we have just a few major powers dictating to the rest of the world. So we can't really look to any big power, any one big power that exists today to be a bearer of truth. You know, they want to suppress truth because their current political social order rests and hinges upon lies, and mainly lies dealing with the Second World War. So we have to look for you know, the smaller countries that aren't corrupted, that don't have, you know, massive, you know, financial forces controlling and pulling their strings. So we can have smaller countries like Venezuela and Chavez, for example, or Iran and Ahmadinejad. I mean, these countries are able, these politicians are able to speak truth to power. They're able to get up on the United Nations and say 9/11 was an inside job, as Ahmadinejad did. You know, Chavez is you know, fervently criticizing the Zionist American Empire. And those politicians have, you know, some principles because they are a smaller country. They don't have as much corrupting influence, and they're able to pursue truth, whereas you'll never find politicians in the Western world today even coming close to you know, unveiling some truth in history. You know, the politicians in Canada or Britain or the United States, Australia, if they even say one thing critical of U.S. foreign policy or Israeli foreign policy, they're condemned, they're castigated and expelled from the political order. But, you know, it's these smaller countries, these smaller powers that still have some principles that are able to, you know, speak the truth and allow their citizens to pursue information that the big powers simply want to prevent you from even looking at.
Yeah, I mean, look at Iran, for example, the conference on Hollywoodism and things like that. I mean, there are tremendous amounts of areas where they are looking into things, which I believe the establishment are very nervous that an entire country have not imposed the same measures and laws in place that exist practically in the rest of the world, at least in the West, right? And it's basically an entity which is not controlled. And I think people have to realize that we might not agree, you know, with their politics or with their stance. It's kind of like how I view, I guess, Gaddafi to a certain extent. It's like, yeah, okay, I don't agree with all his politics. I'm not saying it was like, you know, roses and, you know, all good things happening right there either every time. But it's their own will of how they want to operate the country. And if there is something,
right,
you know, I've said this for years, but if there is something which is wrong within the country, then it must be up to the people within the country to turn that around for a number of reasons. First of all, it's self-determination, but I think right, the second is more important, and that goes to saying that, you know, if we become dependent on letting someone else do the job for us continuously, we're going to get decapacitated in our ability to resist this kind of tyranny and this kind of illegality against, you know, our own as our own people. And that dependency is very dangerous because that means right, we're not going to be able to cope with those kinds of scenarios if and when they arise again. So it's very important, I think, that no matter how much, you know, how difficult it might be to see something that goes on within these countries. But the problem here is what we saw lead up to the Iraq war, for example, that a lot of the material that are kind of these accusations of how brutal the leadership is, they were based right, on lies in many cases, too. We've just completely fabricated, right, you know, like the babies being thrown out of the incubators, this kind of stuff, right?
Exactly. So, you know, I focus a ton on wars and how wars are started. And for the most part, every major war, not maybe not in history, but every major war in recent history has been predicated on a myth, on a lie, on a fabricated terrorist attack or a fabricated attack or an attack that was allowed to happen. You know, things like Pearl Harbor, very much allowed to happen. They knew it was coming, wanted it to come, provoked it by enforcing an oil embargo on Japan. You know, every major war that the United States has launched in the past, you know, 100 years has been, you know, based upon some sort of fabricated event. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, demonizing these world leaders, there's such a hypocrisy to it, because, you know, even when we look at the Iraq war, something I write about in my book Grand Deceptions, you know, Saddam Hussein for a long time was an ally and a puppet, many would claim, of Washington. He was receiving weaponry from Washington. They were training his army. He launched an attack on Iran in 1980 with the full backing of the United States, you know, because in 1979, the Iranians had the Islamic Revolution and deposed the Shah, who was a Western-backed dictator. And to punish the Iranians, the United States sponsored Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran, and he used chemical weapons, chemical gas against the Iranians with the full sanctioning of the U.S. government. I mean, they were fully complicit with that. And then at the tail end of the war, the Americans trying to bully the Iranians into coming to the table with Saddam Hussein and making a peace deal. They shot down an Iranian civilian plane, killing 300 people over the Strait of Hormuz in order to browbeat the Iranians into not taking down Saddam, because they were winning that war. So, I mean, you know, when we look at these things, these governments are totally comfortable with propping up tyrants and dictators. You know, today we hear all this rhetoric about democracy and like this is the most legitimate form of government according to the politicians of the West, insofar as that it represents people because they vote for it or something. But, you know, they don't even really follow their own wisdom, because in many parts of the world, the U.S. backs and sponsors and props up all kinds of tyrannical forms of government, monarchies and dictatorships that completely suppress their own people and put their own people down. When they protest, they send out the storm brigades and the stormtroopers to shut down protests. And these regimes are built up and trained, and their police forces and armies and militaries are sponsored by the West and by the United States. So this rhetoric is very delusional. It's completely discredited. It doesn't have any credibility. This idea of political legitimacy, it doesn't really exist in reality. I mean, the idea of legitimacy is really in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, one person says the government's legitimate, another person will disagree and say it's not. And in terms of the West, it's really just a matter of interest. You know, Western regimes today, they'll call certain governments legitimate insofar as they serve the interests of this ruling class in the United States or in Israel. And then they'll deem other governments illegitimate because they don't serve their interests. It's just a matter of interest. It has nothing to do with any serious concern for the will of the people. That's always used as rhetoric to hoodwink the masses. For example, I'll just give you one example of Vladimir Putin. You know, he tried to cite the will of the people insofar as the Crimeans decided to rejoin Russia recently, and he annexed the Crimea. But at the same time, he has brutally suppressed the separatist movements in Chechnya, Dagestan, and other parts of Russia. He even arrested a guy in Karelia, which is in northern Russia, which used to be a part of Finland, was annexed by the Soviet Union during the Second World War, taken by force by the Soviets, parts of Finland during the Winter War. And this man simply said that he wanted a referendum to have independence for his region, which was illegitimately stolen by Russia during the Second World War. And Putin had that man arrested and charged him with extremism. So, I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the political class, not just in the West, but in many parts of the world, is it really just amounts to what serves their interests and the interests of their backers and not the will of the people. The will of the people is just cited, you know, selectively to justify some sort of annexation or foreign policy or whatever. It's not really serious. So these politicians are just total liars. You know, they're there to serve themselves and the political elites. And you know, I kind of wanted to get a little bit into the Libya thing and then move into the ISIS thing, because it started with Libya.
Can I ask you about something else first? It's kind of connected to what we're talking about here too, and it was – I wanted to just talk a little bit about the rise of Zionist power to the world stage, pretty much. Now, I think one of the ways, or the primary actually way that this was achieved, was that it was built on guilt and shame. And I think guilt is a horrible way to impose on somebody if it's built on falsehood. A tremendous, you know, manipulative effort to try to make people, fear and, you know, the right. Basic disassociation from their own parents or grandparents or even great-grandparents, and look at the money machine that this has turned into as well, you know, guilting people to go along with this extortion. And this extends way beyond now the people who were actually involved in these alleged crimes. I mean, they're imposing right. it on the innocent grandchildren in Germany, for example, and, of course, the people in Palestine that are nothing to do with this whatsoever. So if Israel is built on lies and guilt, this is one of the reasons why it's not going to survive in the long term. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that really strikes to the heart of the matter, and the current New World Order system that was established after the Second World War is very much, you know, it hinges upon this guilt complex that was created as a result of the Second World War. You know, Germany and Japan are, you know, forced to abdicate, to, you know, capitulate, to admit that they're guilty, to admit that they're wrong in World War II, to, acquiesce to all of these charges that in many instances were fabricated after the war by, you know, contrived by the vengeful victors in order to create this good versus evil, good guys versus bad guys narrative with which to launch this global domination project at the end of the war. So, you know, after every war, we have to ask, you know, the victors write the history. Can we possibly take seriously what the victors are claiming? Obviously not. So when you have a world war such as that of World War II, and only one side is condemned, and only one side is put on trial, we have to totally pick apart these claims and look into this and ask ourselves, is this serious? You know, is this yeah. just another kangaroo court? And that's exactly what we have. And that's, you know, the foundation of this, you know, Zionist American empire is this idea that World War II was the good war and the just war. I mean, you have people who will even question, you know, World War I and say that was probably a bad idea and there was no clear-cut good and bad guy. But when it comes to World War II, the propaganda is so overwhelming and it's so widespread. And it's so enveloping that, you know, even people who are naturally skeptical, you know, go along with this good versus evil narrative. And it's just compounded by Hollywood movies and popular entertainment to the point where people just can't escape it. But you know, when we look into that and who started the war, I mean, anybody who's involved in a world war, I mean, there's really no clear-cut good and bad side. It's just belligerents and different actors with different interests. So this idea of just putting all of the blame on one side is clearly a manipulation of reality. So this is what we have in World War II and this extortion racket that you mentioned. You know, what was needed after World War II in order to justify the creation of the State of Israel was this victimhood narrative of Jews are the most oppressed and persecuted people in the world that need their own state or else they won't be safe. So this is the propaganda cloak that they used to justify the ethnic cleansing, the mass murder that took place to create Israel. Israel was birthed through sin, through ethnic cleansing, through the mass destruction of over 500 Palestinian villages, and all of this evil was swept under the rug vis-a-vis the Holocaust narrative, the Holocaust story, which is an extortion racket and a victimhood propaganda narrative that is used to shield the Zionist movement from criticism. So when you even look into how it got started, they also wanted to create this good versus evil narrative as a way of extracting money because, you know, at the end of World War II, some of the big powers said, let's not even have a trial because it would be clear hypocrisy. We accuse them of aggression when we're guilty of aggression. We're guilty of aggressive warfare and invasions and everything that we accuse our vanquished foes of. We bomb civilians. We carpet bomb Dresden and Hamburg and Tokyo and nuke Japan and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. Yeah. You know, we starved to death millions of Germans after the war in death camps. You know, the Soviet army mass raped German women. So how could we possibly have a trial where everything we're accusing our enemies of is actually what we're supremely guilty of. So they really just wanted to execute the entire leadership of the Axis forces, and instead of having a show trial, which everybody would understand was a show trial. But the Zionist movement wanted it because from their purview, they needed to, one, create this Holocaust narrative to, you know, sort of have it become an establishmentarian, you know, forced narrative that everybody has to believe and that gets taught in schools. So they needed governments to sanction this narrative, to give it credibility by having this trial and putting these German leaders on trial and having them admit to stuff, but which was, we know now, was extracted through torture and so forth. So they also wanted a verdict because they wanted the reparations money. And Mark Weber has a good essay on the Nuremberg trials, and he quotes a Zionist leader named Nahum Goldman. And Nahum Goldman was the head of the World Jewish Congress, the World Zionist Organization, and things like that. And he admitted in his memoirs that he came up with the idea of a Nuremberg tribunal because he wanted, you know, like I said, to create this Holocaust victimhood narrative of the 6 million, but also to get a verdict so that they can establish reparations money going from Germany to Israel, which we see today. You know, Germany continues to pay millions of dollars to Israel. And that was you. That money, for the most part, was used to build the foundational structures and the infrastructure of Israel. So they wanted to guilt trip Germans into basically footing the bill for Israel. You know, that's essentially what the plan and policy was from the beginning. So when we talk about World War II and all this stuff in the State of Israel, none of this stuff happened on a whim. It's not like World War II ended and then they decided, let's have a state of Israel. The Zionist movement from the very beginning, which started back in the late 1800s, had intended to colonize Palestine, had intended to set up a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland, not for the reasons of protecting Jews from persecution. That was the cover story. But it really was to fulfill these biblical prophecies that they had envisioned, that they had, you know, held dear for so many years, and really implement this bizarre messianic vision that they had. So, you know, in the Old Testament, for example, it talks about Jews returning to the homeland and things like that. It talks about in the book of Isaiah how, you know, you will suck the milk of the Gentiles, right? You will, all the wealth of the world will come unto thee, and you will boast in their riches. So, you know, there is this racial religious supremacist undertone to, you know, Old Testament Talmudic Judaism in itself. That doesn't mean all Jews believe that or follow that, but certainly there's a number of Jewish leaders that do believe that and have that vision and want to enact that vision in the world. And they do it through manipulation. They do it through bribery, you know, using banks and corporations to corrupt politicians to carry out their vision. So, you know, the Rothschild family is very involved in all of these schemes, and, you know, has controlled politicians and had them on strings, basically. So, you know, the late 1800s is when the Zionist movement kicked off. You know, Theodor Herzl with his book, The Jewish State, and other Zionist leaders who started to really promote this idea that Jews need a homeland. And they fabricated mythology about Jewish victimhood in order to justify that. And this is also when we see, and it's not a coincidence, the promotion of the 6 million story. So in 1897 is when Zionism started, and the Zionist movement got kicked off and started holding these Zionist Congress meetings to lay the framework for what would be this Jewish state. But also they started pushing in the media, and I have many examples of this in my book, Grand Deceptions. They start coming out with the story that 6 million Jews were in danger or were on the brink of a Holocaust or were being persecuted in some way. And they use this number 6 million, 6 million, 6 million over and over again. It's this Kabbalistic number that they hold dear. Not that it has any legitimacy in reality. It's just that they felt like this is the number we had to use because it fits biblical prophecy. So really this is a religious narrative. It's a made up fictional religious concoction So, you know, back in 1902, for example, I quote, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica, which references 6 million Jews in Romania and Russia are being systematically degraded. You know, 1906, New York Times, a Jewish philanthropist says that 6 million Russian Jews are on the brink of being systematically exterminated by the Russian government. So this was the narrative then, was that Russia, the czars were the bad guys, and the czars were the main enemy of Jews in the world, and that the czars were going to carry out a Holocaust, so they needed a Jewish state. So
despite that the czar let them in, by the way, and housed them, this is what's so ironic in the situation, of course. We did a show on this, too, about how the Bolshevik Revolution came about, but it was, you're absolutely right, it was, they became the bad guy, and they became the people who were... You know, became the enemy. Anyway, go ahead, Brandon.
Right. So they invent various boogeymen and attribute evil intentions to that boogeyman, whether it's the Tsar, whether it's Adolf Hitler, whether it's Ahmadinejad today or Saddam Hussein. They need an enemy, and this enemy it creates this tribal solidarity amongst themselves and gives them a common cause, because otherwise they kind of be fighting with each other too, because they have disagreements. But this victimhood complex and persecution complex is used by the rabbinical class within Judaism to sort of corral the lemmings within that community into following some agenda. So, you know, to go on with this 6 million, I mean, this is very intriguing, you know, this idea that 6 million Jews died in World War II. I mean, that's not the first time they claim this. You know, back in 1914 during World War I, you know, I quote from New York Times articles, you know, dating back to 1914 here, that say 6 million Jews are on the brink of extermination. 6 million Jews are starving to death. There's a quote from 1919, the American Hebrew, that says 6 million Jewish men and women are on the brink of a catastrophe, and they also called it a Holocaust, right? And then going into the 1920s, they continued to promote myths about 6 million Jews in Russia being killed by the Tsar. But this is at the time when the Bolsheviks were raining havoc upon Russia. So.
Yeah. Millions, countless right. of millions of Russians that died. It's just unbelievable right. how the world has turned its back on this to a large extent.
So you had Lenin and Trotsky, who killed millions, who created artificial famines to starve people into submission, to create this Bolshevik regime. You know, there's an article from 1922. This was during the heat of the Bolshevik insurgency, the very tipping point of the massacres that were taking place in Russia, and they're still claiming 6 million Jews are facing extermination by massacre in the New York Times. So what this amounts to is just a propaganda campaign to cloak their own crimes, you know, to cloak their own intrigues and malfeasance in the world. So they've sort of turned reality on its head. They've created a victimhood narrative when they're victimizing others, when they're persecuting others, when they're implementing terroristic policies to achieve their ends in the world, and then they just kind of attribute their own bad deeds onto people that they don't like. And this is kind of what we see today with the Muslims, and they're trying to vilify Muslims as terrorists, but the biggest terrorists in the world today, the leading terrorist states, are the United States and Israel. So, you know, the 6 million needs to be dissected, because, you know, we've had, you know, during World War I, they're pushing the story, but the problem is that they didn't get the narrative to stick, because there wasn't any singling out of Jews during the First World War, right? There wasn't any government in Europe that singled out Jews for persecution, unlike World War II, where Hitler made it pretty clear that he was trying to kick them out of Europe. So they couldn't get it to stick in World War I. This is important, because, you know, they've tried to create and concoct this narrative of victimhood, but they didn't really have the circumstances that necessary to that are, were conducive to that narrative, right? They didn't have any sort of one thing to point to that made that narrative believable. But this changed with World War II. So they failed to get the State of Israel going after World War I, but they did accomplish getting a British approval of that plan with the Balfour Declaration of 1917, where the British government signed a document addressed to Lord Rothschild, who was basically the robber baron banker of England, and they said, we will help you establish a Jewish state in Palestine. And the real story behind that, which is never talked about, and it doesn't appear in any mainstream history, is that that pledge by the British government, known as the Balfour Declaration, was acquired through bribery, and it was a sort of an exchange where Chaim Weizmann, who was the head of the World Zionist Organization, he admitted in some of his memoirs and in a letter that he wrote to Churchill, which was unearthed by David Irving. He promised the British that he would use the power of American Zionism and American Jewry to bring the U.S. into the war on England's side. So this was during World War I. He goes to the British, proposes, please help us create this Jewish state, and we will give you an American partner in this war. We will drag the United States using our influence in media and politics to bring them into the war on your side, and you will win the war. That's exactly what happened. It happened exactly as Weizmann said. And a similar thing happened in World War II. Chaim Weizmann, again, who's this kind of Zionist leader that went around bribing and browbeating politicians to get on board with the Zionist project, he made an identical proposal during World War II to Churchill, and he says, Churchill, help us create a Jewish fighting force in Palestine that will be used to, of course, drive out the Arabs and keep them at bay to help form the Jewish state, carve out the Jewish state. Train our army for us, and we will bring America into World War II on your side again. And it happened. He says, you know, we did it in World War I. He admitted it. He said, we did it in World War I, and we're keen to do it again. Right? And so this is the hidden story of the world wars. You know, back in 1903, a Zionist leader named Max Nordau at one of the Zionist congresses actually predicted World War I. He says there will be a world war, and he said 6 million Jews will perish. You know, this prophecy of 6 million Jews. So it's this idea, it's not merely coincidental that they're just prophetic and they just predict these things. It's just that they manipulate it from behind the scenes and they make it happen through their power of money and media. So this whole story kind of coalesces with World War II. Because, you know, they got a few pieces of the puzzle together. They got the British on board with helping them create the State of Israel, with training Jewish militia fighters to ethnically cleanse the area and make it and prepare it for this Jewish takeover, this Zionist takeover of Palestine. So they were just making their way towards their end goal throughout the world wars, and all the while promoting this 6 million story at the same time. So the World War II was so perfect and convenient for them, and they immediately launched into an agreement with Hitler known as the Transfer Agreement, which saw the transfer of tens of thousands of German Jews to Palestine, as well as agricultural equipment and money. So right away, the Zionists were keen to work with Hitler because Hitler provided them an opportunity, because the Zionists wanted Jews out of Europe. They wanted them in Palestine. They needed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Jews to create this viable state, a state that was an ethno-state, that they had enough people to maintain it and keep Arabs at bay, you know, kick them out and keep them at bay. So Hitler was sort of a gift for them in the sense that he had a similar agenda, and he wanted to kick Jews out of Europe, and so did the Zionists. So they worked together and moved many thousands of Jews out of Europe.
Yeah, exactly. Palestine. And I mean, there's even these, like, there was coins that were minted that both had a swastika and a Jewish star on them, for example. There was a large cooperation at the time, because it was a kind of a, of course, everyone didn't agree with this, but nonetheless, on the political top at the time, there was an agreement. But of course, what happened later is interesting, when which has been referred to as the great stab in the back, right? When, despite that the agreements were made, they turned on Germany, and actually what we saw happened is what we saw happen, and this is when the extermination of Germans began towards the end of the war, and particularly after the war, right?
Right. So these things are completely hidden from public view. You know, when we look at any World War II or World War I historiography, it's never mentioned. You know, the Zionist intrigue is never mentioned. It's simply kept out of the debate, and that's obviously for a very good reason. They don't want you to know that this entire war wasn't manipulated from behind the scenes by people with very, you know, sectarian interests. So we had all these people, millions of people around the world, fighting in a war that they had no personal benefit to be involved with. There was no real motivation for any of these countries to fight this war. It only benefited a select few people. That's the bankers at the top who profited, the weapons manufacturers who profited, but also these geopolitical schemers like Weizmann and the Zionists, who wanted to use the war to accomplish their goal of creating a Jewish state. So, I mean, the World War II coalesces with this Holocaust story and narrative, so they have been trying to push it in World War I. It didn't stick because they didn't have the circumstances conducive to it, but it did stick with Hitler because he did single them out. He did round them up and put them in concentration camps. He did somewhat persecute them.
Sure, of course.
In Germany.
It doesn't mean that and this is one of the criticisms against people when they talk about this and they believe, they think that you're trying to say that nothing ever happened or something like that. It's not the case at all. It's just taking an approach to the subject that is a bit more balanced than the one we're getting. Of course people suffered. Of course there were casualties all over the place. This was war, and this is one of the greatest reasons, I believe, why we did also see so many deaths towards the end of the war, when all the supply chains were cut off, all the disease and the typhus and everything that hit at that stage. And there's a lot of different explanations for why the carnage happened and why things unfolded in the way they have. But they have piggybacked their own political issues on these things and say, oh, no, it was solely due to policy. It was solely, you know, this was in the books, et cetera. But it's very difficult to prove that, in my opinion.
Yes. So, you know, from the get-go, from day one, when Hitler came to power, the Zionists were comfortable with it because they wanted somebody to drive Jews out of Europe and get them to Palestine. In fact, Theodor Herzl, in his memoirs written decades before World War II, said, we will use the anti-Semites and to control our lesser people, our underlings, the lower Jews that we want to, you know, control. And we'll use them as sort of a way of driving them and corralling them like cattle. So he proposed actually working with leaders like Hitler, who for their own reasons were anti-Jewish or whatever, saw Jews as having too much influence in Germany, and for their own reasons tried to do things and limit their power. But the Zionists basically manipulated Hitler and other leaders like him to accomplish this Zionist agenda, this goal of transporting European Jews to Palestine to fulfill this Jewish prophecy of returning to the homeland and whatnot. So Hitler was manipulated by the Zionists, and he was actually driven to become more harsh, and the Zionists were keen on making him, you know, clamp down on Jews in Germany and surrounding areas harsher than he even would have otherwise. You know, Zionist leaders deliberately provoked Hitler and said things like, the Jews of the world were united against Germany and they were speaking in the name of all Jews. And this was quite deliberate, and it was quite calculated to cause animosity towards Jews. So it was the Zionists who instigated this animosity and tried to encourage it in order to accomplish this goal of transporting Jews to Palestine, because otherwise most European Jews at the time simply weren't interested in going to Palestine. They were comfortable in Europe. They were sort of ruling the roost in many cases. So why would they leave and go to Palestine? It didn't really make any economic sense why Jews would leave. So World War II was the event that was needed to sort of finalize the Zionist project. In World War I, they had the, you know, support of the British government to help them create the State of Israel and to train Jewish fighters, which later became the terrorists that took over Palestine. But they didn't have the victimhood narrative, and they didn't have the guarantees from Germany in terms of the reparations money that was needed to finance this whole project. And this is where, you know, Hitler, you know, fills the role of, you know, the great persecutor of Jews, who deliberately singles them out for victimhood and persecution, puts them in camps and so forth, and then these camps they're able to come in after the war, manipulate the narrative, embellish the role of the camps, you know, create lies lies and propaganda about the genocidal nature of these camps, when in fact they were used for labor purposes. Not that that's defensible in any way, but the fact is that they had the narrative now. They had the Holocaust story used for decades to come to whitewash the Zionist project, this murderous colonial project in the Middle East, which had no real justifications or reasoning behind it to exist. It exists of Zionists and their backers, and through the manipulation of emotion through the Holocaust narrative. So the Holocaust narrative has been fashioned and weaved through the manipulation of events in World War II, and has been wielded as an ideological sledgehammer by the Zionists ever since to mask their, you know, sort of atrocious behavior in Palestine, their consistent, you know, ethnic cleansing, consistent massacres of the Palestinians to carve out this Zionist imperium. And the Zionist imperium was the birth child of the Second World War. You know, it was sprung out of this you know, guilt and persecution complex that was fashioned specifically for that purpose.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here in a little bit and, of course, continue to talk more. Time just flew by here. We're going to, of course, try to get to ISIS and talk more about Libya and all these very interesting things. You have some other things you've written about. I want to ask you about more as well. I just wanted to mention that it's so bizarre to hear some of this material, due to that it's so contradictory to so much that we've been told for our entire lives. This issue has been viewed through a single lens for such a long time, so one-sided that it's kind of bizarre to get the other side. But you mentioned the newspaper articles, and I also want to mention that too, that there is a video obviously out there that details this. It's about 20 minutes long. I think there's a faster version, if you will, of this too, but it shows some of the clippings that you referred to, and it's just very interesting to see this, and people have to start wondering at that point, like, okay, wait a minute, if this is a number that's gone on repeat for you know, 50 years since, I think it was 903, right, was the earliest reference someone found here a while back. I think the video, I forget exactly where that goes from, 1912 or
actually,
something.
It was actually the late 1800s people have found.
Was it? There you go, yeah. So, you know, it's bizarre. But, folks, I'll link up that video on the program page here. Take a look at that. See what you think. What the hell is that all about? You know, very important, very interesting too. But Brandon, before we take a short break here, please tell us about your titles. We've hardly, you know, gotten time to speak about any of those. Of course, you do talk about the foreign policy issue in a lot of your books as well. Give us your website. Give us your book titles.
Okay, the website that I publish on mainly is nonalignmedia.com. That's the website I run with Joshua Blakeney. My other website is martinezperspective.com, where all of my articles are also up on there. And as far as my books are concerned, my first book was Grand Deceptions, Zionist Intrigue in the 20th and 21st Centuries, which deals mainly with 9/11 and also World War II and the things that we've talked about. My second is Hidden History, and this is a collection of essays and articles which deal with similar themes and similar topics as the first one. And my latest one, The ISIS Conspiracy, this is another anthology, a collection of all of my articles dealing with ISIS and the recent developments in the Middle East, and I tie all of these things sort of together, link it in with the Zionist agenda, which seems to be the bedrock foundation of much of what has gone on in the past 200 years. So these things can all be found on nonalignmedia.com. All the links are there.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up, links to the books as well. Okay, stay with us, Brandon. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more. Someday you'll realize.
and you'll no longer burn to be frozen ice. Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle raged high, and
ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, in the second hour we move ahead and look at ISIS, how the organization or group practically came out of nowhere, out of nothing, and was formulated right at a convenient time for Israel as an even more radical Al-Qaeda. And just as that particular group, ISIS or Islamic State, is also supported by those who claim they are fighting it. We'll speak about how it has been promoted in the media, how it has been used, and also the dynamic of ISIS in Europe and why so many young immigrant men from Europe, and specifically Scandinavia in particular, are attracted to go fight for the Islamic State. These are willful dupes being used as pawns on the geopolitical chessboard. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up for a subscription if you haven't already, and you can tune in not only to this second hour, but to any of our previous programs. We are getting close to 1,000 here soon. I guess we should have a kind of a millennium party here coming up, I guess. But anyway, our full archives are available for you on the website. We also have videos, TV episodes, webcasts, and we have some music and some other things for you as well. So do take a look around at redicemembers.com. But before we continue, let me mention some of our upcoming guests. We have Mike Campbell on what happened to Amelia Earhart and how FDR is part of the cover-up. We also speak with Brian Anse Patrick, Mike Walsh, Patrick Wood, Alex Newman, Ulla Damagård, Christopher Hell, and Dr. Colin Ross, to name a few. Right, folks, stay tuned. We'll see you on the other side of the break.